Welcome to Spaghetti Launchers, the world building podcast where we throw spaghetti at the wall and it is up to you what sticks. I'm Kyle.
I'm Ethan. Today's episode, we're ordering some takeout and we're talking about Mass Effect.
Mass Effect is, I think, the most frequently cited video game in this podcast history.
Video game, yes. General media,
no.
No.
No, but frequently cited because it's an incredibly expansive universe within Mass Effect, the Mass Effect games. All four of them. One of them is terrible, but the other three games, phenomenal masterpiece.
I think we cite Star Wars more.
I don't think that's true. I think we probably cite D&D the most.
Well, yeah.
And then maybe, I don't know. If you have a theory about what our most frequently cited properties, let us know. But
Dragon Ball Z.
No. So Mass Effect has a whole lot going for it. It is a franchise near and dear to both of our hearts, mine in particular. And it is, you know, it has some stuff that's just like, oh, it's a generic sci-fi, you know, rah, 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 rah. But it has a flavor that actually does make it stand out, and it is unique.
People were pissed about the ending of the third game for a reason, because
it was fine.
But it was fucking beloved, though. People just loved it. Like, you don't get backlash like that.
For a thing that nobody cares about.
That nobody loves.
There's a reason people were mad at the end of Game of Thrones.
That's right.
They ruined it.
Because they loved it. And yeah. Which is a testament to how good it is. And it's, which means that there is a lot that we can learn from it and a lot to be taken from it.
Yeah. You know? There's so much. We've already used it for inspiration for several ideas. The Keepers, who are the little.
Kyle loves the Keepers.
They are. They're.
Kyle just fantasizes about not having to clean up his own house.
I clean happily. I like cleaning. I am not the person that you should target that accusation at. The Keepers, who are like the maintenance, the non-communicative maintenance people for the Citadel, and just exists forever. They just kind of hang out. Also, worth noting, we're going to spoil the hell out of these games probably. So if you've never played the Mass Effect game, we're past the point of...
It's 2 years into this podcast. It doesn't matter.
Well, also, we're, you know, like 13 years past the final game coming out.
Yeah, the statute of limitations has expired.
But... So, you know, they're fantastic. We talked about Thane Krios, who is the coolest assassin.
The religious assassin who
hates that he does what he does. But this is his gift and he must use it. And he weeps for everybody that he kills.
Yeah. We talked about the flotilla, the Quarian world ship, and the gathering of the fleet that acted as their home world.
Because it's not even a world ship. It's just they have a bunch of ships that all just go together. They are.
Isn't there one big one that they call the world ship, though? Am I misremembering?
I don't think
that?
So. I think the... No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. I think there's like capital ships, but I don't think there's like a specific world ship. Because the Citadel is like a world ship.
I don't remember. Citadel, no, I know that. But
the Citadel is ripe for so much cool worlding. It is a beautiful place. It's where you really get lost in the lore for the first time in the first game. So much within that to dive into. There's a lot. And we can probably just start with some ideas because why not?
Yeah. Kick us off.
Okay. I want to talk about the Ardat Yakshi.
Ooh, oh.
Which... for the uninitiated is a what?
The uninitiated, as you proceed to talk about a very exclusive cult.
It's not a cult. It's so the Ardat Yakshi are a subset of the Asari race, who are a monogendered female presenting race that exists, and they live for like 1,000 years each. And there is this
subset. They're distinctly the elves of the Mass Effect world.
Yes, they are, but with a interesting coat of paint all over the place. And there's a small number of them that have a genetic defect, essentially, that makes them a super-powered Asari, in that if they like have sex with you, they will take your
soul,
your life force, your power. They basically absorb you.
Very praying mantis.
And you die.
Yeah.
But then they become more powerful. And they can just keep doing, and they are like seductress extraordinaire. They can use basically their powers to seduce you and force you basically.
Which Asari can, all Asari can do to an extent. It's just supercharged with them,
right? It's supercharged, so they can really like take advantage of this and just absorb all the power in the world that they want. But, and it's like one, it's like less than 1% of Asari have this trait.
That's like 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 or something like that.
Or like 1 in 1,000,000. I don't even know.
Yeah.
But then they have a tradition where they will sequester themselves at monasteries to live peacefully because they know basically they have this dangerous disease that means that they can become ultra powerful and a threat to society. And they have a pretty like well-run society. They are prosperous and calm, and they are the elves. They've got their shit figured out.
They're like half elf, half Bene Gesserit.
Sure. And but then these are like the like, oh, but you know, we're the wild cards. Yeah. And but they go to live in these monasteries peacefully. And then but they can also not. There is a whole quest in the second game where there is
what happens if one doesn't, which is
it's a good quest.
It's a great quest. I loved it because it reminded me I this is not based in science at all, but it's the someone said once, like, if you release a house cat out into the wild on the local, it will be like a hurricane on the local ecosystem.
Yeah, it'll be very dangerous. They just start they start killing birds and all types of stuff, right?
Right, just to survive. And it's like unleashing havoc because they don't have that socialization of being raised in part of a colony.
Yeah.
Right? That where there are social hierarchies and cats are very social animals, but if you take one that's been alone and just unleash it onto the world,
you don't know what'll happen.
It's gonna be fucking chaotic. I heard this on like a CSI TV show. I don't know if it's true, but having owned a lot of cats makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, fair. And so these colonies, these monasteries, they're monasteries, you know what they refer to them as. This is whatever they want to talk through. Is I don't think like the Ardent Yakshi concept of the creature that can have an exponential power gain over, you know, or just a linear ramp up of power gain that can go forever, you know, just by doing a basic thing and having the ability to do that pretty easily because they can seduce. That is one thing, and that's dangerous. And then the monastery is a separate thing that is also awesome. Both of these ideas can work, as you can take both of them and then place them in a new world. The idea of the peaceful sequestration of those who are a danger to society, but not because they're criminals, because they have some like genetic
vampiric.
They have some like genetic advantage / disadvantage that will make them a threat, and they have willingly chosen to, because they understand it is like a sacred duty to get yourself to these monasteries, and they live well while they're there, but then and they are allowed passage to leave if they're, you know, deemed to be, you know, not a huge threat, and then some just like are like, yeah, well, I'm gonna fucking go rogue and kill everybody.
So what I love about what, and I remember thinking this when I was playing the game, is how much of a role reversal it is, because normally there's so much focus on, I need to find this rare superpowered individual, right? It's like, oh, there's this prophesized birth of the, you know, the seventh son of a seventh son, right? That's going to be someone so powerful they can change the world. Or the legendary Super Saiyan, right? We need to look for this one. They're only born every 1,000 years or every 100 years or whatever. We got to find them. They're the savior.
Yeah.
This flips that idea. It's like, we need to find this person and then keep them locked away because they cannot be used. And this is, it has nothing to do with, like you said, who they are as a person, but they need to be locked away for the good of everybody because of how powerful they are.
It's very interesting the way you framed it. I'm like, that's very reminiscent of the Dragon Reborn in the Wheel of Time.
I was thinking Randall Thor.
I was like, this is Super Dragon Reborn. And I mean, that is more nuanced of, because there's the debate of, is it you cage the Dragon Reborn or you let them, you know, lead the last battle or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's also, that is the true chosen one. This isn't that chosen.
No,
this is like, there is a randomness of like every 1,000 or 10,000 kids, there will just be one of
these.
And then please go to the monastery and live well. And I think the way that you handle that, because, you know, say within this world, if you made it where the mother goes with and, you know, and friends can come with, and you create more of a colony where whoever is the Ardent Yakshi cannot leave, but their loved ones can. But then you might invite the opportunity for them to, you know, do their thing. But they can't really do their thing if it's only other Ardent Yakshi there.
And this is something that's very important, is that for this to work and work well, it cannot be discovered that the monasteries are secret Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters, X-Men training camps. They also cannot be horrible, evil places to live.
That's a separate thing. That's a separate trope.
It has to be a good, safe place to live.
It's a monastery.
But that's very important to this working.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it, that's natural because they're very powerful.
Yeah.
And some of it is, it's almost that, it's like, when the kids and like when a kid and a parent are playing and it's like the kid is in charge and like trapped the parent and the parent's like playing along, like, oh, I'm trapped in the behind the fort, what do I do? But mm-hmm. in reality the parent could just go and just yeah. destroy the fort and walk out.
Yeah,
that's kind of what you have here, is like the Arctic actually are super powerful and maybe you can contain them, but they're probably more powerful than the regular guards unless they've got something else going on to, you know,
sure.
to contain them. But so there is like a power dynamic of like saying, this is a social contract you have made. We will make your life really nice, but in exchange for you just hanging out here.
Yeah.
And in the, like, because I think in the universe, they are also, they create like specialty products where it's like monasteries where like, you know, we're brewing beer, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, we have specific honey or
what is the honey they make?
I think it's honey. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, you can do some specific thing that really leans into it. I think the way that you plug it into a specific world is depends on what is the threat within your world.
Sure.
Because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have to just brainstorm a bunch of new threats that you could come up with. But it's the idea of the, please just go live here and not as a prison, just as a, let's all just, we all know this is for the best. You know, it's a colony. It is yeah. a, you know, it's semi-exile.
It is exile, but it is self-inflicted exile.
It's exile. With,
it's you're selecting yeah. to live an ascetic life, and what's important about that is,
well, maybe not necessarily ascetic. It doesn't have to be. They can live lavishly. They just
sure fair.
You're choosing to live a physically contained
life. I meant the ascetic. The you're living remote. You're living isolated from society.
And you could even have them not be that remote.
The two things that are sticking out for me is, one, that fantastic line from the first X-Men movie, which would still ring true here, is, well, what happens if someone does try and go attack the monastery, right? Or poison the monastery. It's like, well, I feel a great swell of pity for whoever goes to that school looking for trouble.
Yeah, it won't go well.
It's like, that's a great line. What's also important here is that whoever your the great threat is or the antagonist has to be something that is powerful enough that releasing or leveraging this monastery as a resource would not necessarily turn the tide of battle. Because releasing the Art at Yakshi and incorporating them into the fight against the Reapers wouldn't have changed much.
Yeah.
It would not it would have caused more problems than it would have gained. So
it would just mess with like your troops.
But that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is that you need to have, they need the power scaling balance is important.
Yeah, because they're powerful, but they're not, you know, beyond right. anybody else's right. power. Like, you know, you can still shoot them.
Right. Because otherwise they are the secret weapon that yeah. you unleash.
And that's not, and that ruins the idea.
Yeah. It defeats the purpose.
I back to the physical location. Thinking through remoteness versus, you know, what if they are in the capital city? What if there is a, and not like a, you know, not an ivory tower to hold them in that proper cliche, but if there is a, there's a big, you know, monastery, you know, somewhere in the city where people can walk by and see, you know, like across the fence, they can see, you know, then there's like a big, maybe there's a river blocking it or something where you can see the Arctic Yakshi who might wave. And they show, like showing that to society that this is a group of people who understands their sacred duty to their species and to their society mm-hmm. to do this thing that is to other people might seem difficult and, you know, unfair. But they say, you know, it is like reinforcing the message of we have a social contract together and this is our duty. You might have your duty as well. And like giving that visual representation to other people and not sequestering them out of sight, but and not out of mind, but at least, you know, having them right there where, you know, they could have visitation in some way, but there's preventative measures of some kind, but there's a proximity that's close enough where people can be like, oh yeah, good for them. Critically, not othering them, because othering them creates this interesting dynamic that can be problematic. But it, you know, it can be fun, but sometimes I think for what we're going for, that isn't actually what you want.
It's not what you want. I think it's also more so, it's not what you, it's certainly not what you want. More so, I think it's important because whatever the monastery is, whatever the lifestyle at the monastery is, has to be attractive enough so that any type of personality would be able to find a satisfying life there.
Yeah.
Not out there giving in to the urges that their powers create in them.
Yeah. Good point.
Because
and maybe there's multiple monasteries where you can choose
of different types and different lives. And sure, maybe, and I'm not trying to be funny here. Maybe there is one where they send all the sociopathic superpowered people and there is some,
it's the most remote one.
It's the most remote one, and there, but it's, and it is a sort of a hellish landscape where they do sort of just drop them off. But even still, the story about them, they cannot be secret. The monasteries and the people cannot be secret. They have to be known enough, and so that even the antagonists will say, if someone dares say, "Oh, we need to, we can, why don't we unleash the monastery and use them on our side?" Are you fucking crazy? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
We are not doing that to ourselves. That will be worse for us than anything else.
Well, and
that story, that narrative has to be self-reinforcing there.
And I mean, you get the obvious friction and conflict that exists within Mass Effect of when you have the sociopathic, the ones who don't want to, you know, who don't want to participate willingly in the system. And that's a question that, you know, the individual, you know, world builder can answer, because how you want to deploy this will dictate whether or not you do have those sociopaths who are just running around being crazy, or if it is people who, you know, it is a statistical anomaly if there is a sociopath, you know, that in reality, like in this world, it's actually that, you know, they're so like in the nature versus nurture conversation of it, they're so nurtured to buy into this system, into these ideas, that they are happy to go, you know, live the peaceful sequestered life, you know, for the good of the group.
Sure.
And then maybe one in 1,000 Artigakshi types are a sociopath. I don't know. You figure that out on your own. But I think...
Do they need to be identifiable at birth? Or...
I don't know.
I don't remember when the Artigakshi are identifiable.
I don't know.
I think it's when they're young, when they're you already see who they are as a person a bit.
Yeah, probably. I mean... Yeah, it's up to the individual version of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's about it.
Yeah.
I like the Artigakshi. I think they're cool. I think they should be deployed
elsewhere. I think the Asari are fucking great.
The Asari are a great... They're a great species. They are the best species in the games from a world-building perspective. Well, they're the they're the most dynamic and useful. Most interesting, probably, the Hanar.
I think they're also the most alien.
No, the Hanar.
The who?
Yeah, exactly. They're the jellyfish-looking species that communicates with telepathy. And
and they've created
anti-gravity fields to float, and they worship the... I think it's the Salarians. They're crazy cool. They're really weird.
I forgot
about those. The Elcor, who are emotionless, and they have to announce their tone before they say it, because they're so monotone, so they'll say sarcastic, and then say a sarcastic comment.
I forgot about them, yeah.
Yeah, there's great, like, the species that are most interesting are the most, and the most alien are the least used, because they're really hard to keep deploying, because they're hard to relate to.
Yeah, which kind of gets into the point that I wanted to discuss, which is...
What is it?
I want to talk about fertility issues.
Oh.
The genophage,
in yes.
particular.
The genophage is fucking wild.
The genophage is the cruelest thing that we've seen in Mass Effect.
It's cruel, yeah.
I think it might be the cruelest thing. Basically, it's for the uninitiated. It's the virus that the Salarians release that slows... Krogan birth rates to effectively nothing.
It's the DNA rewrite, I think. It's like a virus or whatever. It rewrites the DNA of the Krogan to ensure that their fertility, which is normally through
incredibly
the roof,
high,
is basically like one. I think it's one in like every like
a thousand. Like it's 1, something 000, very, very
like 10,000 births it actually succeeds.
Lives, yeah.
But then also their birth rate is like 10 times that of a normal person. Their birth rate is, you know, significantly higher than everybody else's, in part because they're based off of, you know, all of the species in a lot of the species are based off of animals in our world, and they're based off of frogs,
right?
And so they're like, they just plant a bunch of, like, they lay a bunch of little egg tadpoles or whatever, I forget how frog fertility works, but then they just can produce like 10 at a time,
yeah,
and then they go from,
because, you know, they produce in closer to litters rather than one to one,
and they go from birth to maturity
so very fast. Quickly.
It's, you know, like how a baby giraffe can immediately walk.
And it affected their battle strategy and why they were such a dangerous opponent to the Salarians, because...
To everybody. And
because
they repopulate.
Right. Every soldier... It was like fighting a Hydra.
And they got to that point because everybody else basically brought the Krogan into like modern times and took them from their remote planet because of their potent ability to fight and use them in the Rachni War,
right?
Who they were having a hard time killing in the Rachni. That's were destroying right. everything. And they said, well, we'll unleash the Krogans. The Krogans demolished the Rachni.
Right. And then had another problem.
And then they had another problem is when now the Krogans are now a spacefaring, aggressive, conquest driven species who will destroy us all.
Right.
What the fuck do we do?
That repopulates at 10 times faster than we do.
And then the Salarian intelligence says, well, why don't we destroy their fertility rate? And that is where we begin. Go.
It is a very common trope in fantasy to have, and sci-fi, to have different races. The Krogan, Mass Effect in general, the Krogan specifically, are one of the first times where actual biological differences were not just impactful to character design, but actually to story, plot, and world. Beyond just the fucking drow having sunlight sensitivity, as an example,
and in the dwarves world. Being good, like being underground
and good miners. Like,
yeah,
none of that actually matters. It's just, it falls back into the tropes of, oh, well, our elves are different. Cause like in The Dragon Prince, well, our elves have horns and we have sun elves. I'm like, that none of that is actually different. None of that actually feels
in every story alien. It's like, where it's like, oh, well, like this species can live like for 1,000 years. And sometimes it's relevant. Like Lord of the Rings makes it relevant as hell because it's fucking Tolkien and he's the boss.
But I mean, everybody else, the idea of these different things being races instead of truly supernatural beings originated with him, and they were influenced by mythology.
Yeah. But my point being was like, that's the only time I've seen the lifespan really matter. Great scene in Rings of Power where Doran is furious at Elrond, and he's so hurt because Elrond hasn't been there in 70 years or like 20 years or something.
20 years.
Yeah, and to Elrond, that's been a blink of the eye, but to Durin, that's like, you've abandoned me forever. And it's like, well, that's a great example of where the biology actually matters. Right. But in so many other stories, it's just, oh, well, like they live for 50 years, they live for 250 years. Moving on, never relevant.
Doesn't matter.
Like, but they do.
And it matters with Arwen falling in love with Aragorn. Like, yeah. It matters.
Tolkien's the only person who ever did it right.
It matters interpersonally, but not cosmically, worldly, whatever the fuck adjective is, I don't care. The point is, if you are going to actually have different races or species or ancestries, whatever game system or world that you're calling them is, if you're actually going to have different species, unless they are deliberately based off of humans, in which case, if they are, fine. Say that, though.
Yeah.
Account for that. That's important.
Yeah.
If they are going to be biologically different, like the elves living for thousands of years. I was there, Gandalf. I was there 3,000 years ago.
Well, Elrond, the strength of men fail.
But that's older than the common era. That's before Jesus at this point.
That's before the earth.
That. Oh, I got it. I was like, what happened to you, man? Where the... What?
The earth is flat. The earth is flat.
Yes, it is. It is, Kyle. We've been over this, but it is also still billions of years old. So, you know what? Just...
Solid.
Get over it. Just, I'm right. Get over it.
That was like a weird... That turned so like genuine and hostile. And
Kyle.
It left
Kyle. Kyle.
Okay. Okay.
Kyle.
Okay. I accept the world is round.
No, it's flat, motherfucker.
Oh, wait. I forget who's on what side of
the bit. It's flat, but it's billions of years old. It can't be round and young. That doesn't make any sense.
Yep.
I know. Thank you. I'm brilliant.
You're just... The point, show this to Kyrie Irving.
The point that I'm trying to make here is that if you're going to do these things, if you're going to actually have different species with different traits, unless there is some reason for them to have shared a common ancestry with humans, with your human-based species, typically human-based species, right? The same way most mammals have a common ancestry at some point, then Yeah. Otherwise, they are going to be different, and it will be important to discuss what are the implications for that on your world.
Yeah.
If an elf dies, that's a big fucking deal, because maybe their gestation is 100 years.
Yeah.
They cannot replace these. But if dwarves, and I'm making this up off the top of my head,
okay,
if dwarves are in fact carved from stone and then brought to life, yeah, then dwarves can be replicated way faster.
They should be more populous.
They should be way more populous. And that would also give some explanation as to why the dwarves love the earth and also are great craftsmen.
Because the earth is their mother.
The earth is their
earth mother. Is real.
Is, but it's completely real. If they have to be, right, that would, and that's very similar to, I think in Diablo, it's an angel can only be born when all of the other existing angels gather in one place, sort of like a Mount Sinai equivalent, and sing in their choir, their chorus together.
Yeah.
And it's through that magical crystal pillar that another angel emerges.
Yeah.
Those all have implications on those species' beliefs, moralities, battle strategies, politics. Think through these things.
I think also it's in the context of Mass Effect, it's, you know, like, say the genophage doesn't happen. If you're playing the game, you should only really be encountering Krogans, because the statistically, they would just be the vast majority of the species in the world or in the galaxy, right?
And that is a type of reproduction. I forget what, there's two types of survival of the fittest, one of which, though, is that you just have a birth rate high enough that
you just outnumber everybody.
And your species just survives because it's too difficult to kill.
Yeah. Well, and my point being, there's also like there's the cultural visibility that you would get in a world, in a story. So like, in Mass Effect, you're mostly, you go to the Citadel, you go to like colony planets. You don't spend a lot of time on capital planets at all. You basically never do, except for T'Chanka, which is the Krogan planet. And there's no one really there because there's not that many Krogan.
Mm-hmm.
If you did, like, then the population becomes so much more of a question. So you can kind of sidestep that. But in so many other worlds, if you have elves and dwarves, and the elves take 100 years to gestate, and the dwarves are carving themselves out of stone, you would have
so many more dwarves.
Every character you interact with would be a dwarf, and it would be really hard to find elves, and that makes the story weird. And it would take away a lot of the flavor, which is, I think, why people kind of gloss hand over it. And then they hand wave it. But there is, I think, and I think on that front, it's fine. But when you're looking at stuff like the battles and the war, that's where it becomes, you need to put it back into the deck, because
you can't stop considering it. Like,
yeah,
you can discuss like that, and that's what I was saying about Tolkien. Tolkien does it really well from an interpersonal perspective, but it doesn't show up much else.
I think I think it does show up in the fact that, you know,
the politics. It does.
Well, I think also like the elves send a small contingent to Helm's Deep, which is a big impact. But every one of those deaths, you feel a lot deeper.
Didn't that happen only in the movie though, or did that happen in the book?
I think it just happened in the
movie. Yeah, but even still, the point still stands.
It's still like one. He's still portraying it. Yeah, you know, like Peter Jackson's portraying it pretty well. But you know, like there's a reason why the elves aren't doing another march.
Yeah,
they're not going. You know, well, the humans aren't going to Mount Doom either. But like, they don't have the numbers to do this. They're leaving Middle Earth. They're going. You know, to the Greylands or whatever.
And it would be very cool to have someone just even an offhand line about our people can't keep.
We don't have the numbers.
We don't have the numbers to reproduce and to make a difference. And so instead of trying, we're taking the L and we're leaving.
Yeah. And
really just have Arwen say it is, oh, it's so difficult for elvish women to give birth. Like, what is that going to mean for my relationship with Aragorn if he wants a son? You know, say something like that.
In the context of that, if a human and an elf are creating a child, is that a simpler process because the human fertility rate is higher?
Maybe.
And that's a question that like is interesting to ask in a world is like, they're more half elves because humans have a much higher fertility rate than elves,
which would be really interesting. And that is, there's something. All right, let's talk about D&D for a second, because in the 2024 version of D&D and the recently released book, they got rid of explicitly half species.
Yeah,
where you can say flavor an elf or an orc as a half elf or a half orc, but there is no more stat block for them.
They were OP,
huh?
Half elves were OP, so it's fine.
Which is fine, but that also says something about the world, right? Which gets into one of my frustrations about D&D, which is going to be a whole other episode of a podcast where they're...
I think that's literally all of D&D, YouTube, Reddit, everywhere. Yeah, it's all just done. People it's love to much. Complain about
D&D. Yeah, because they love it. And so you complain about
shout out to Matt Colville's video from like this week.
Yep. You and I watched the same one.
Yeah.
But the point is that that also does say something about the world is why are there now no more half species?
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. Yeah. And game rules, stat blocks, and systems that are only half engaged with the world make no sense. Either you need to give things like in his new game where the stat blocks are fully baked into the world and there are reasons why there are no half elves or half orcs,
yeah,
as he has said, or just give standard flavorless stat blocks that you can pick from and then flavor on your own.
Or just don't have any species. You know, and
but that would be the other category.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
flavorless stat blocks.
Bringing it back to Mass Effect as the core of the episode is, you know, thinking about that of, you know, the Asari. The Asari could just have sex with, I think, every species that has reproductive organs.
I think so.
But they can't be impregnated by any of them. And that's interesting.
How do they reproduce again? I forgot.
I don't know.
Asari reproduce through a form of parthenogenesis called melding, where they link their nervous systems with a partner's using the partner's electrical pattern to randomize their own DNA, resulting in a 100% Asari offspring.
Boom. There you go. That is an interesting way to counteract a lot of the questions that you would have, because Mass Effect just has no half species of any kind. And you can have sex with Turians and Quarians and Asaris and everything in between. And it's just, all right, well, it doesn't... These parts don't align from a biological perspective, so like, there's no fertility issues here,
right?
Because you can't fertilize each other. But fuck away, it's fine. So, yeah, I think this is a really good point of like the biological differences matter beyond just the like flavor and the interpersonal. They should, and they must have a consequence to the way the world functions for it to maintain its verisimilitude, because logically, the Krogan would dominate, and the world accounted for that and said, well, we'll make sure they don't.
Right.
And we get a fascinating conflict, lots of interpersonal dynamics, lots of juice is made out of this by actually letting the biology of these species matter.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
No notes.
No, well, plenty of notes. Please see the preceding 15 minutes of conversation, but plenty of notes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great.
That's what stuck for us. No.
Well, what sucked for you?
I mean, I love a monastery. I love that. I love thinking about what having different types of monasteries for different types of personalities of people, because they have to be attractive enough for someone to want to stay there.
You have to apply to like the college that fits you.
Basically,
to the monastery you want.
But you have, because otherwise you're going to want to go use your powers and and if that power, like in with Arta Yakshi, is hunger based, then you're going to want to go use it. So what is going to make you not use it?
I think an interesting point thinking about that more is they should also be able to freely move between the specific monasteries to say, well, I'm tired of this one, I'd like a change of scenery.
Yeah, can it's like a network. Yeah,
can I transfer to another monastery? They say, sure, yeah, no problem, of course.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we have a spare bed there, it's all good. Yeah.
So I like that. I also do, not for nothing, I was making it up, but I do like the idea of dwarves reproducing by carving each other from stone
and fucking slaps,
breathing life into it. That's and that also explains why they are such good craftsmen, because they had to be in order to keep reproducing themselves. And then you can have like, oh, what are earth golems? Like maybe earth golems are just the original dwarves that are still living and walking around before they started refining their craft. But suddenly again, like a whole world just opened up in front of me. So that might kind of stick for me. Actually, that might be the thing.
Yeah. I think that's, it's quasi the thing that sticks for me, because I think that's a great example of it. I think the whole...
I was just making that up, too. Top of my head.
That's how this podcast goes. We make it up as we go.
Yeah.
We only come in with a prepared nugget, and then we...
Yeah.
And then we carve it into the final product, which is the dwarf.
Yeah.
I think the conversation we had on yours is... It might become one of those new sticking point questions when looking at a world.
Yeah.
Is saying, You know, like, you know, you watch a TV show or a movie or whatever, and you're like, yeah, it sucks because there's this huge plot hole that I can't get over. And then now I might be like, well, I can't look at this world because there's a huge plot hole. And that is that the species biology isn't relevant. And right. like that might now become a question that I ask of any property is going, yeah, but how's the species biology play in it? But that's rare to have a new thing join that list. And that's kind of cool. And that definitely will stick long term.
And it makes you ask questions about the world and think really deliberately about we listened to a presentation about this a few months back where a friend was asking, why do we feel the need to have different species in these stories at all?
Yeah.
And
especially because they're usually like racially coded and fucked
completely.
Up.
So think really deliberately about why you're including this. Like, what are you trying to tell in a story about this?
Yeah.
Be very, very deliberate and careful with how you use these things. They're taken as such a trope of just, oh, of course there are elves and dwarves and bird people. And it's like, well, they don't. That is one thing that Brando Sando does well is I think most of his.
It's all just humans.
It's all humans. Yeah. And it's.
Different flavor of human, but it's all
humans. But it's all humans. Yeah. So what, you don't need this shit. So yeah. why are we doing it?
I mean, I'm going to throw Star Wars under the bus. Why the fuck does Star Wars have all these like species that their different speciesness is just for like on-screen flavor and has no bearing on anything else? Yoda is an exemption, but most of the other ones,
yeah.
Yeah, it's just flavor and that's fine, but Mass Effect made it matter. And
I think it was better for it.
It was. All right, well, that's what stuck for us. Let us know what stuck for you. Email's in the show notes.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.